All right, everyone. I hope lunches came out all right. My name is Tony Jackson, and I am an articles editor on LPAR. Next up, we have Shelley Welton presenting her article, Non-Transmission Alternatives, which was originally published in the Harvard Environmental Law Review. Shelley Welton is a PhD in law candidate at Yale, where her research focuses on the effects of climate change on U.S. energy law and energy governance. She holds a JD from NYU School of Law, an MPA in Environmental Science and Policy from Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs, and a BA in Environmental Studies from UNC at Chapel Hill. This summer, she will join the faculty at the University of South Carolina School of Law. Before pursuing her PhD, Shelley works as a deputy director at the Earth and Climate Institute at Columbia Law School Center for Climate Change Law, and serves as a clerk for both Honorable David Traeger of the Eastern District of New York and Allison Duncan of the Fourth Circuit. Joining us via video will be Michael Panfil. He is an attorney for the Environmental Defense Fund Clean Energy Program. His work includes federal, state, and regulatory efforts across the country to design a more environmentally friendly, economic, and efficient electric system, with a particular focus on California, New York, and New Jersey. Michael also engages in efforts to reduce emissions throughout the United States by advocating for the deployment of smarter technology, improved design standards, and sustainable practices. He received his JD from Columbia and holds a BA from the College of Worcester. We also have Randy Elliott, who is a senior regulatory counsel at the American Public Power Association. He assists APPA and its members with energy policy analysis and advocacy before federal courts, FERC, and other agency and policy forums. Before joining the APPA in 2014, Mr. Elliott was in private law practice here in D.C., where he represented municipal utilities, electric cooperatives, and other clients in matters involving wholesale electricity and transmission rates, power contracts, RTOs, and utility mergers and acquisitions. Before that, he was in the office of the solicitor at FERC, representing the commission in federal appellate litigation. Mr. Elliott is a graduate of MIT, the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and Harvard Law School. Finally, we have Michael Gergen, who is a partner at Latham & Watkins here in D.C. He has extensive experience developing practical applications of economic theory, corporate finance, and regulatory law to assist clients in the energy industry and other network industries to compete successfully in an environment of market-based open access competition. His work has earned him recognition from clients and legal industry publications alike. He assists clients in development and use of federal and state financing support and incentive programs focused on clean energy technologies, products, and services. He received his JD from NYU, an MS from UC Santa Cruz, and a BA from Antioch College. In addition to his practice at Latham, he is an adjunct professor of law and a member of the board advisors for the Institute and Policy for Policy Integrity at NYU School of Law. Thank you.
I'll go ahead and get started. I'll start by echoing everyone's thanks for Vanderbilt and ELI hosting this event. I'm really honored to be included today. And one challenge of the project that I'm going to talk about on non-transmission alternatives is that it focuses on a topic that's identified primarily by what it is not. So I want to begin by answering the question, what are non-transmission alternatives? And then I'll get a little bit more into my argument. Okay. So I want to do that by starting with what is an admittedly oversimplified explanation of how transmission planning works, but I think it will serve for our purposes. During transmission planning, grid operators look and try and project what future sources of demand for energy are going to be. So I have that represented here with the picture of the city, and what supply is going to look like in the future. And then they figure out how to connect areas where demand growth is anticipated with sources of supply, so maybe like with a wind farm or with a natural gas plant. And they look at the various ways that you might do that, and they pick a transmission project that makes the most sense. And this used to be done at a very local scale. It's now typically done at a regional scale, either through regional transmission organizations where those exist, or by regional utility-led processes where those don't exist. Now, the basic idea behind a non-transmission alternative is that sometimes, instead of building that transmission line, it might make more economic sense to instead work on reducing demand at the area of demand growth. So You might do that through energy efficiency policies. You might do that through distributed generation, so small-scale local resources like solar panels on local roofs. You might do that through demand response, so working on just cutting that city's demand at periods of peak demand so that it doesn't need as much transmission infrastructure. And sometimes non-transmission alternatives might prove considerably cheaper than transmission alternatives. And they have additional benefits. So depending on the kind that you use, they might lower air pollution, they typically reduce the need for distribution infrastructure, and they can stimulate the local economy. And NTAs are particularly important because I think it's pretty much undisputed that the United States definitely needs significant growth in its transmission infrastructure in the coming decades, particularly if we're going to increase our reliance on renewable sources of power, so things like these big wind farms I have pictured here. So some estimate that U.S. utilities, and that's us by extension, who are their regulated monopoly customers, are going to spend as much as $50 billion per year over the next decades on transmission and distribution upgrades. And transmission is not only expensive, but it can also be really contentious. It often has a lot of troubles getting siting and financing approval. So avoiding it where it's possible to avoid it is an important part of responsible grid planning. Now, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is the agency charged with overseeing interstate transmission in the US, has recognized that non-transmission alternatives are really important. And it has, as part of a larger and what I would say is a very commendable set of reforms in transmission regulation, has professed a goal of creating technology neutrality and giving non-transmission alternatives comparable consideration within these regional processes that plan for the future transmission grid expansion. But it hasn't really given any particular methodologies to its regions as to how to accomplish this comparable consideration for non-transmission alternatives. And as it happens, non-transmission alternatives are very rarely proposed within these processes, much less actually implemented. So I want to talk about three reasons that I think that non-transmission alternatives fail within these processes. And the overarching argument is that regional transmission planners, who are, after all, experts in building transmission, are half-heartedly implementing FERC's reforms, and FERC is letting them get away with it. So there's three major challenges that I think our current processes present for non-transmission alternatives. So first, under regional processes, regional planners do not themselves explore any possible non-transmission alternatives. Instead, they just permit stakeholders to propose these alternatives for consideration. And FERC defines stakeholder really broadly to include any party interested in the regional transmission planning process. But that is admittedly a very small subset of humanity. And it typically tends to be utilities, states, and civil society groups like environmental organizations and consumer advocates. And none of these stakeholders, I argue, really has the right mix of incentives and expertise to propose a non-transmission alternative. So the second problem is that even if a stakeholder could put forward a viable non-transmission alternative, comparable consideration is really challenging in these processes. Now, no region has actually come out with a detailed methodology for how it's going to achieve the comparable consideration FERC has asked for. And that's likely because a lot of non-transmission alternatives benefits are environmental and social, and these present real comparability conundrums. Both FERC and Circuit Court precedent suggests that FERC cannot consider non-monetized environmental benefits when it's weighing transmission solutions to create just and reasonable transmission rates. So, even if a non-transmission alternative, from a total societal cost perspective, turns out to be cheaper, it probably can't triumph in the comparable consideration framework as it exists today. Okay, so the final and most important obstacle that I want to talk about facing non-transmission alternatives is that of cost allocation. So, one of the most significant things that FERC did in its recent reforms of transmission planning, particularly through its Order 1000, which implemented in 2011, was that it required regions to come up with some sort of method for allocating the cost of new transmission lines among the utilities and the regions that benefit from it, so that they could stop these infighting over how to pay for new lines, delaying or obstructing the construction of really necessary transmission. But FERC refused to extend cost allocation to non-transmission alternatives, and it just said it's beyond the scope of the order. So the problem that creates is that any utility that wants to build a non-transmission alternative is going to have to shoulder the entire cost of the project itself, even if that project has benefits beyond that utility. Whereas if the same utility built transmission, it would be able to use this cost allocation process to share the cost of the project among all of the beneficiaries of the project in the region. So that creates an obvious incentive for anyone wanting to build a non-transmission alternative. Okay, so I argue that the current reforms, with their heavy reliance on stakeholders, are unlikely to do much to alleviate the challenges that currently face non-transmission alternatives, and that this makes FERC's reforms in a way much more cosmetic than they are substantive. And then the question becomes, what can you do to create true technology neutrality within these planning processes? All right, so I have a few more substantive solutions to propose. The first is you could require regional analysis of non-transmission alternatives. Regional transmission planners are in the best situation to actually look at feasible, implementable non-transmission alternatives, and FERC could simply put a mandate in their rules that say, you need to look at reasonable non-transmission alternatives and analyze them. And such a requirement would both help mitigate what is typically a transmission-first culture within these entities, and then also draw those with the most expertise in grid planning into the analysis of non-transmission alternatives. So second, to unlock this comparability conundrum I was talking about, FERC could require regional planners to develop more specific metrics to evaluate non-transmission alternatives and transmission solutions side by side in the same process. Now, that's not going to fix the jurisdictional constraints that I'm talking about. It's not all of a sudden going to let FERC evaluate all of the environmental benefits that we might like it to look at with non-transmission alternatives, but it will highlight the places where there are asymmetries in the process. And it may well reveal that there are instances where non-transmission alternatives can compete with transmission solutions on an economic cost basis alone. Okay, so the third thing, I have a question mark after it, and that's rethink cost allocation. When I originally wrote this paper, we were operating in a world where the D.C. Circuit had just struck down one of FERC's most innovative recent orders. They said, FERC, you cannot include demand response in your wholesale markets and dictate its price because demand response is under state, not federal jurisdiction. And based on that precedent, I said, FERC probably can't actually do cost allocation for non-transmission alternatives. And so it was wise not to do it, and maybe we could have the states work together. But in January, the Supreme Court just reversed this decision. And it said, FERC, you can include demand response and dictate its price in your markets because demand response's participation in your markets directly affects rates that are within your jurisdiction. And I really think that this EPSA decision opens up space for FERC to reconsider whether or not it might extend cost allocation to non-transmission alternatives. Just as demand response directly affects wholesale electricity prices, the participation of non-transmission alternatives when they're cheaper will directly affect transmission rates. I do think the argument is more tenuous for non-transmission alternatives than it is for demand response, but perhaps we can get into that later. So I want to also just make one further, more overarching suggestion for reform in closing, which is a call for more honest admissions. So given all this turmoil around the boundaries of its jurisdiction recently, I do think FERC has some completely understandable reasons for having moved slowly on non-transmission alternatives to date. But even so, if FERC believes, as it says, that incorporating non-transmission alternatives into the planning process and giving them true comparable consideration is an important part of its mandate, then it's really ill-served its responsibility to create just and reasonable rates by pretending to have solved this problem when it has really barely scratched the surface. So I also call for FERC to be a bit more forthright in admitting those policy spaces where it feels like using its admittedly outdated governing statute, the FPA, to solve modern-day grid and transmission planning constraints is difficult in order to advance a regional and national conversation about the best way to address important challenges like non-transmission alternatives. All right, so I will leave it there. Thanks very much, and turn it over to Rin.
Thank you, and thank you for the invitation to be here and the opportunity to comment on the paper. I had not seen it before. It was sent to me, but I had to, when my first reaction was, wow, somebody has delved into an issue that I've practiced in a bit in such depth, and it's a prodigious amount of work, and I really compliment Shelley on her effort here. And it's also, I'm not an academic, but I would give her an A for her issue identification as well. About a year ago, I was in a meeting in my organization. I work for a trade association that represents the government-owned public power utilities in the country, mostly state and local agents of state and local governments that own power systems. And we were discussing things like the New York Reforming the Energy Vision proceeding, in which state commission there is taking a reexamination really of what it means to be a distribution utility and what kinds of services should be provided by distribution utilities in the future, and what new market entrants will be allowed and how they'll be accommodated and regulated. People providing distributed energy resources, storage, microgrids, that whole constellation of things. And I thought, well, how has this all gone how is this state-led, mostly, reform initiative, how is that going to interface, if you will, ugly word, but I don't usually use, but with federal regulation, as it's been historically done by FERC? Where are you going to draw the lines on, and Shelley's article puts that issue front and center. So the fundamental question is what kind of policies should we have, regulatory structures, that enable us to get the optimal mix of transmission facilities, which we need to bring in wind and solar from distant locations to load centers, but without overbuilding it, because there is so much more we could do at the distribution level that really obviates the need for transmission construction. So I think she's square on in addressing an issue that's critical at this point. So my comments were really focused. I mean, there was still a lot you could comment on. And so my initial outline, I had to scratch lots of things off. Just wanted to highlight a few things. And Shelley's right that the non-transmission alternatives is sort of a very vague phrase. FERC doesn't define it at all, really. And it's sort of, you know, it's things, it's kind of a negative. I mean, it's a very odd thing. So what is it? And I think that'll be a key thing for FERC to grapple with, is to define what that is. Some things that you might consider a non-transmission alternative are, under the law and under FERC practice, transmission facilities that are, I mean, a substation is not a transmission line, but maybe you could build a substation, put in capacitor banks that accommodate electric flows. They may obviate the need to build a large transmission line that people would oppose, but they're nonetheless, they're squarely within FERC's wheelhouse to control. But then there are other things like distributed energy resources and you know, the rooftop solar, things like that, that FERC's really had a hands-off, heretofore approach to, things that have been regulated by the states, and I think the states will tenaciously want to hold on to regulation of them and will oppose FERC inserting itself into that process. And that's one of the dynamics that was in the EPSA case, FERC versus EPSA case, and it's even more squarely involved in the Hughes versus Talon Energy case that's pending at the Supreme Court right now. But that defining what we're talking about, what transmission alternatives and who has jurisdiction over them, will be a critical issue. Unexplored in Order 1000, and I think that's will be something important. I also talked a little bit about the issue of comparability, a phrase that's used in the order. And Shelley's quite right that they really don't explore it enough, and she calls for them to say what they mean. What do you mean when you say comparably examine non-transmission alternatives and transmission facilities in the planning process? And she's right on there. They don't say what that means, and in the compliance filings that FERC has handled since then, they haven't really provided much guidance either. And so she's quite right that more needs to be done there. And I really actually kind of question the use of the term comparability in my comments, because that has a very particular meaning in 25 years of history of FERC regulation, really, of this area. It came to mean, it's an implementation of the statutory phrase undue discrimination. Ordinarily, that phrase meant a utility had to treat two customers who are similarly situated the same way. Couldn't unduly discriminate among its customers. FERC then used that quite correctly, I think, in a clever way, to say that, but there's also an element of undue discrimination between the transmission provider and its customers. And so if you're going to provide adequate transmission service to third parties who may be your competitors, a transmission provider, you've got to provide them the same quality of service and the same comparable quality of service at a comparable price that you really provide yourself when you use the transmission system that you own. And that's how comparability, as a particular phrase, came to be used in the FERC lexicon. And that's how it's used in orders in the open access order 888 in 1996, and in the follow-on orders that have required transmission planning to be done in conjunction with open access transmission service, orders 890 and now order 1000. It's an extension of the comparability principle. Not only do you have to provide comparable service at comparable prices, but you also have to plan your transmission system in a way that provides comparable planning to third parties, to customers, and not just plan the system to suit yourself, but to plan it for all users on a comparable basis. And so when FERC says, and consider non-transmission alternatives comparably to transmission, what do they really mean? I think they're not just saying consider the non-transmission alternatives of transmission customers, although I think that's important. I think they're meaning something else. They're meaning some kind of, don't discriminate between them, but they've really never explained what they mean. And I agree with Shelley on that point. In fact, I would take it a bit further, and I would say ditch comparability, because that has a particular meaning, and explain what kind of non-discrimination principle you're applying. How does it apply here when you're talking about transmission versus non-transmission alternatives? So let me segue to my second point then. And Shelley's analysis of the stakeholder process and its deficiencies, I think, is right on. In terms of analyzing the biases and the incentives of the various actors. I would only add to that I thought that it would benefit by talking a bit more about transmission customers, who are the ostensible beneficiaries of this transmission planning regime under Order 1000 and of the entire open access regime. Transmission customers, and a large subset of those are distribution utilities, will be developing a lot of these non-transmission alternatives as distribution utilities, whether under state regulation or on their own, just to meet customer needs and customer demands. So I think they will be natural proponents of non-transmission alternatives in this process. Whether the process will accommodate them and treat them fairly is another question. But I think they are an important stakeholder, if you will, in that phrase, as it's used here, in that process. My own bias from representing those kinds of entities in my own practice over the years is that the transmission process is best if it's a bottom-up process. If the transmission needs of local utilities to meet their customers is the starting point for the analysis, and you combine that and then try to recognize regional alternatives that may be better than doing it each one by itself. But it's best works on a bottom-up process from transmission planning, and I think that's true in spades for non-transmission alternatives, just given the very nature of the technology and our historic regulation of them. So when one of Shelley's recommendations was to require the RTOs and the transmission providers to do regional analyses, and I think that's okay, but I wouldn't want it to come at the cost of this bottom-up planning process. I wouldn't want it to be a kind of a top-down imposed by the transmission owners or the RTOs, particularly the RTOs who have no real expertise in the non-transmission alternative world. So there's a balance there, and I'm not sure exactly what it will be, but I think the place of transmission customers in that process needs to be examined as well. Am I out of time? Okay. All right. The FERC VEFSA case, I'm probably less, Shelley acknowledges it's, you know, the facts are distinguishable here, and I put a few bullet points in my comments on some of the distinctions that came to mind there myself. Disclaimer, my employer, APPA, was a petitioner in that case and challenging the FERC's rule. So I wasn't entirely pleased with the outcome of the case. But I don't want to minimize its significance, but it's still unknown at this point. In some sense, that was an easy case because you had these demand response that was directly affecting the wholesale price of energy, and so it was easy to say that directly affects a rate within FERC's jurisdiction. And the state, under the regime that FERC set up, the state's regulators, who ostensibly would care about retail customer usage and incentives and the demand response itself, they would give their assent to participation in the FERC's wholesale market. So in some sense that made that an easy case. And how far you can extend that to FERC involuntary, doing this against the state's wishes or without the state's consent, and doing it in the transmission world versus the RTO wholesale market world are all open questions. But it is an important case. I submitted my paper on the 24th, I think, in the morning. And about 2 hours later, I saw the first FERC case that I had seen that actually cites FERC versus EPSA and uses uses it in support for what they were doing. And it was a case involving a rural electric cooperative in Vermont that, under the statute, FERC does not regulate. But they participate in the ISO New England transmission system, so they contribute their transmission facilities to ISO New England, but they have some local facilities that they only use themselves. FERC was conducting an investigation of all of the transmission rates in New England, and they included this Vermont cooperative in their order under Section 206 of the Power Act, which only gives them authority to investigate public utilities. It's not a cooperative like this one. And the cooperative objected and said, you don't have authority to look at our local rates for local transmission service that are not part of the region-wide grid's rates, not part of the ISO New England's regional transmission rates. And FERC denied rehearing. It said, no, you're providing that service really in connection with the regional transmission service of the ISO. We worried about you double recovering your costs under both of them, and they need to be synchronized, your local service as well as the ISO service. And so under EPSA, your local service directly affects the wholesale rate, the transmission rate that we have jurisdiction over, and therefore we can require you to be subject to our order. So the full extent of this new the FERC VEPSA case and its application to this area will be interesting to watch. Thank you.
Okay, if all goes well, our next commenter is via video.
Hello, everyone, and my apologies for not being able to join this conference in person. I'd very much like to be there, but the silver lining, I suppose, is that it's harder to go over time on a pre-recorded video. I would like to begin by thanking ELI and Vanderbilt Law School for their invitation to speak at this event. And I'd like to thank Shelley Welton for graciously giving me the opportunity to comment on her paper. I would really encourage everyone here to read her note in full. It's a fantastically thoughtful and well-written piece on an extremely complex and important issue. Now, Shelley's article speaks to the importance of including non-transmission alternatives in transmission planning. And what that means, technical language aside for a moment, is that as we build our electric grid, we should consider resources like distributed solar, energy storage, demand response, energy efficiency, alongside the usual suspects. Now, as an environmental advocate, I like that idea, especially given the electric sector remains the largest source of carbon pollution in the United States. But I'm also drawn to the idea because it's one that provides so many other benefits. Simply put, by leveling the playing field and increasing efficiency in planning, we necessarily expand the solution set. And that in turn means costs are going to be lower for consumers while maintaining or even increasing grid reliability. Now, this trifecta, environmental cost and reliability benefit, is not only a promise but necessary result of better transmission planning processes. And this better and more efficient design is partly due to systemic and foundational changes underway in the electric sector itself. The grid is becoming not only increasingly more interconnected but multidirectional. The traditional system where energy was produced, transmitted over long distances, and used by consumers is no longer fully representative. Instead, power can and is now generated by consumers in the form of distributed energy resources, rooftop solar, for example. And the flow of information is likewise changing. Customers are increasingly able to receive and act upon accurate, granular information about their energy consumption. These changes have opened new pathways and possibilities to achieve greener, cheaper, and more reliable power. And what we're beginning to see is a legal and regulatory structure that is catching up to these advances, most recently in the important Supreme Court decision FERC v. EPSA. Now, this case concerned demand response in wholesale markets, which at least at first blush seems to be perhaps one step removed from transmission planning and non-transmission alternatives. But the legal logic embedded in that decision suggests that regulators can and should pursue policies that make electric prices more just and reasonable, that is, more cost-effective. And that's exactly what non-transmission alternatives tend to do. But opportunity shouldn't end there. It's fair to ask what else can and should be accomplished under this legal framework, which recognizes that jurisdictional boundaries should not be drawn as arbitrary bright lines in the sand, that the grid is truly an interconnected and expansive machine, that environmental cost savings and reliability benefits go hand in hand, and that restricting the sector to business as usual undercuts the very statutes, laws, and regulations upon which this industry was founded. So I'd suggest to those who care about an efficient grid, a cleaner grid, a more cost-effective grid, that we consider new pathways forward to improve how the energy sector operates. Pathways that include, yes, more equivalent inclusion of non-transmission alternatives in transmission planning, but also pathways that include distributed energy resources in wholesale markets. Pathways that include better and more accurate market designs. Pathways that respect important and significant state policies throughout the planning, building, and operation of the grid itself. Now, FERC v. EPSA is only one step, albeit an important one, in achieving these goals. The next will be, I think, found in applying the precedent to new resources and settings where clean energy resources, tools, and practices could provide more just and reasonable rates if given the opportunity to contribute fairly in the sector. Now, I'm confident that we're moving in that direction, given the enormous changes already taking place. And I like to think that as this occurs, technology information will continue to grow and enable system advances, and the consequent benefits will likewise grow. That's my opinion and belief. But as we heard in FERC v. EPSA, FERC's actions on demand response fell within its jurisdiction with room to spare. And it's exciting to me to think what else might fit, knowing how enormously significant the logical next steps forward could be given this jurisdictional breathing room. Thank you. Hello, everyone, and my apologies for not being able to join this conference in person.
It was so good, Latour.
I'd very much like to be there, but the silver lining, I suppose, is that it's harder to go over time on a pre-recorded video. I would like to begin by thanking ELI and Vanderbilt Law School for their...
Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody, and thanks for sticking with us here. I know that after the fireworks in the last panel, I want to thank ELI and Vanderbilt for inviting me to comment on Shelley's paper. And Shelley, thank you very much for your paper. Thought-provoking. Discussion of Shelley's paper is timely. A little more than 2 weeks ago, FERC staff issued a report on transmission metrics intended to assess transmission investment patterns to inform the commission whether additional action is necessary to facilitate more efficient or cost-effective transmission development in the U.S. At the same time, the commission announced that FERC staff would hold a technical conference in June to discuss issues related to competitive transmission development processes. So clearly, Order 1000 is not the end of the story. There's a lot more discussion and dialogue to be had on these issues. And the mix of issues under the Federal Power Act that require consideration with respect to transmission planning for transmission alternatives, such as the role of competition and how to allocate costs, are already complex and difficult. On a scale of 1 to 10, a 10. Adding non-transmission alternatives to the mix takes us up to 11. FERC has recognized that non-transmission alternatives include generation, demand response, and energy efficiency. The article points to what are described as persistent governance and jurisdictional hurdles to truly comparable consideration of non-transmission alternatives that impede their deployment, and points to process-focused participatory reforms mandated under FERC Orders 890 and 1000 is unlikely to overcome these impediments. More specifically, the article asserts that there are three impediments. Impediment one, the U.S. has ceded the function of transmission planning to private transmission-focused entities, creating an institutional bias in favor of transmission solutions. Impediment two, non-transmission alternatives have societal benefits that are not considered and likely cannot be fully considered in FERC jurisdictional transmission planning processes. And impediment three, non-transmission alternatives are ineligible to have their costs allocated among regional beneficiaries. I will separately discuss impediments 2, 3, and 1 separately in that order, but before I close, I want to discuss impediment 3 and impediment 1 together in a little bit more detail. Concerning impediment 2, in the context of FERC's rate-making authority, the lack of consideration of societal benefits is an issue that is not limited to non-transmission alternatives. And as the article suggests, societal benefits may be beyond those that FERC could fully consider even if it wanted to do so, at least in the context of its rate-making authority. The same holds for societal costs as well. For example, it is difficult to point to anything in the Federal Power Act or in FERC's or the court's interpretation of FERC's powers under the Federal Power Act that would allow FERC sua sponte to impose charges or cost adders for societal costs, such as the social cost of carbon. This is not to say that these costs and benefits should simply be ignored in the context of transmission planning. Indeed, a number of states do consider them in the context of planning for traditional utility infrastructure. In some states, most notably New York, which Randy alluded to, are also beginning to take an active look at societal costs and benefits as related to the deployment of and retail level compensation for distributed energy resources. And industry participants are also beginning to take an active look at the comparative societal costs and benefits of decarbonizing the electric industry via deployment of distributed energy resources and associated distribution or via utility scale renewables and associated transmission or some combination of the two. For example, a relatively recent comparative analysis of residential scale and utility scale solar PV systems in Colorado, along with their associated avoided and or increased distribution and transmission costs, as well as externalities, concluded that a utility scale PV system with a build out of transmission is significantly more cost effective. Considering impediment three, the article acknowledges that in Order 1000, FERC determined the cost allocation for non-transmission alternatives was beyond the scope of the order, and asserts that the most likely reason for this determination was that FERC was uncertain its rate-making jurisdiction extended to non-transmission alternatives, which could be viewed as within the retail rate-making jurisdiction of the states. And this is the discussion of FERC v. EBSA. If there was an uncertainty or concern on the part of FERC, I doubt that it was primarily or even largely about the line between federal and state jurisdiction under the Federal Power Act. Order 1000 was issued long before there was any question that FERC could exercise rate-making jurisdiction under its affecting jurisdiction over such things as demand response. Indeed, Order 745, which was the subject of FERC v. EBSA, was issued before Order 1000, and just a few months before. And FERC had actually been issuing orders regarding demand response participation in the organized wholesale markets since the early 2000s. I think FERC was not so much concerned then with the jurisdictional split between the states and the feds, but they were concerned and should have been concerned and should be extremely concerned about extending cost of service type rate making to resources such as demand response resources that cannot function like open access transmission facilities and have the ability to participate in FERC jurisdictional markets for electric energy capacity or ancillary service. It may be a reach too far under FERC's transmission rate making authority to allow a non-transmission alternative to charge for its services under a cost-based transmission service rate. Such cost-based rate recovery could also undermine the workings of the organized wholesale markets if and to the extent that a non-transmission alternative can participate in those markets while obtaining significant cost recovery under a cost-based rate, or have the ability somehow to toggle between cost-based rate recovery under a transmission rate and market-based rate recovery in the organized markets. Indeed, we're having lots of fights at FERC, and we now have a case in front of the Supreme Court. It's really all about the what do we do in terms of when generation has access to subsidies outside of the organized markets, because it creates a problem. Now, in this regard, not all transmission alternatives are equal. An energy storage system, such as a grid-level battery, can function like transmission. Randy mentioned capacitors. A battery can be just like a capacitor. FERC has recognized as much and determined that a grid-level battery can be considered in a transmission planning process and can obtain cost recovery under an RTO's transmission tariff, provided that the battery is not participating in a material sense in the RTO's organized markets. The reason for this limitation is because as transmission, the battery would be under the operational control of the RTO, which under FERC's open access rules and policies must not be a market participant. Moreover, when it comes to cost allocation, not all transmission alternatives, much less non-transmission alternatives, are equal. Some are eligible for regional cost allocation and some are not, depending on their function and their intended beneficiaries. Thus, even if non-transmission alternatives were to be considered for cost allocation, it is not clear they would be eligible for regional cost allocation. Concerning impediment one, the article asserts that FERC has over-relied on participatory reforms that have resulted in planning processes in which participants voluntarily propose transmission and non-transmission alternatives. The article also asserts that this is a ceding of the function of transmission planning to private transmission-focused entities. FERC has never acted as a planning agency with respect to transmission, and it has no direct authority under the Federal Power Act to do so. Historically, such planning has been the responsibility of state public utility regulators and or incumbent utilities. Thus, it is not surprising that Order 1000 limits its practical focus to transmission alternatives considered in participatory planning processes. At its core, Order 1000 is about introducing competition to transmission planning. That competition is somewhat limited by design and currently at its earliest stages. It suffers from a number of flaws, some of which are described in the article. Nonetheless, Order 1000 represented an important first step towards competition in transmission planning processes. Before Order 1000, non-incumbent transmission developers were effectively shut out of the planning process. I had the unfortunate experience of representing a number of them in projects involved in California and PJM. Since Order 1000, and as noted in the recent FERC staff report on transmission investment metrics, over the past 3 years, the percentage of non-incumbent proposals in California and PJM has been on par with those proposed by incumbents. Now, considering impediments 3 and 1 together. Often heard statements from friends and clients who are actively trying to develop both transmission and non-transmission alternatives, and I do have them, and they do both, follow the money, And money talks and policy walks. Put simply, incentives matter. Given that the planning incentives in Order 1000 are in and of themselves practically limited to transmission alternatives, and non-transmission alternatives may not have any ability to obtain transmission-based cost recovery, how can FERC ensure that non-transmission alternatives are afforded comparable consideration? And ultimately, how can FERC ensure that those obligated to pay for these transmission alternatives are paying rates that are just and reasonable? Here, the article offers up an interesting proposal as related to cost allocation, namely, deny regional cost allocation for a transmission alternative when it is outperformed by a non-transmission alternative. I would like to expand on this proposal as the incentive-related carrots and sticks available to FERC under its transmission rate-making authority could be used to do more, not only to incent the transmission planning processes that are designed to provide comparable consideration of transmission and non-transmission alternatives, but that participants in the planning process are incented to propose appropriate least cost solutions. And Randy alludes to this in his written comments, which is, I think, there already are incentives for customers to want to be involved in this process. But you know, what FERC could do is require regional planning processes to have an RTO or an ISO or a utility identify actual or expected needs for transmission. And that could be, if it's like reliability, there would be a transmission criteria violation. And that those needs, it requires a solution. And they could then solicit proposed solutions, both transmission and non-transmission, through an open and transparent process. Some RTOs and ISOs already do that. Now, rightfully, you should ask the question, why would anyone propose a non-transmission solution if that solution cannot obtain cost recovery? Well, the short answer is that transmission customers in our entity seeking to protect the interest of transmission customers, such as a state public utility commission looking out for the interest of load-serving transmission customers, should be incented to ensure that cost-efficient non-transmission solutions are considered. FERC could also require that all proposed solutions, both transmission and non-transmission, be evaluated by an RTO or an ISO, or an independent third-party evaluator in the case of an incumbent utility. Independent third-party evaluation of competing proposals for utility infrastructure or power supply are not uncommon in the electric industry, as FERC requires such an evaluation for certain types of utility affiliate transactions, and many states require such an evaluation for most types of utility procurement. Here, an evaluation could consider societal costs that are germane to FERC's rate-making authority, such as deferred transmission costs or distribution costs or reduced congestion costs. In turn, FERC could condition rate recovery for a transmission alternative selected as is being compared with non-transmission solutions. For example, if the evaluation determined that a non-transmission solution, which could not have been selected because no one would have ever built it because they couldn't get cost recovery for it, was precluded, but it was outperformed the transmission alternative, FERC could, in its rate-making authority, basically look at the return on equity for that transmission solution and put it at the lower end of the range of reasonableness. And I won't get into the details of what that means, but basically it means you're going to get a lower return on equity than you likely would have gotten just if you had been approved in the planning process. And you certainly aren't going to get incentives, which FERC offers to some transmission projects, which actually could put you in the upper end of the range of reasonableness. And believe me, if you're a utility, that matters. What your return on equity is, it matters. Now, these are merely suggestions intended to recognize the legal and practical limits on what FERC can do under its existing Order 1000 framework and its existing rate-making construct for transmission. If we want to move beyond that framework and the construct, we may want to consider a more fundamental change to how FERC sets rates for transmission-related solutions. For example, FERC could consider some form of performance-based rate making in which revenues are dependent on measurable outcomes, such as reduced congestion costs, as opposed to administratively determined inputs, such as rate base, return on equity, and depreciation. Such an approach might also be more amenable to providing transmission-based revenues for non-transmission alternatives, at least those that are combined in part with the transmission alternative. So in closing, I want to thank Shelley again for her thought-provoking article. It is a good beginning to a more searching and comprehensive critique of existing transmission planning processes and possible reforms. Thank you.
I want to say thank you, thank you so much to both of you, well, all three of you, for taking the time to comment on my paper. I feel like spoiled by this whole experience. I'm afraid I'm already at peak readership and I haven't even started my first real job. Okay, I can't respond to everything and I know we're over time, but let me just say a few things. You guys both talked about the incentives of potential people playing in this process. I like the idea of thinking more about who we can get to the table to propose non-transmission alternatives. I want to think that states have the incentives you're identifying, but they're not doing it. And so, I mean, part of the article is just to say if the person with the right incentives existed, I think that somebody would have come forward with one. I love the idea that distribution utilities might be the ones to do this. I have a lot of skepticism about whether investor-owned distribution utilities are going to be incentivized to do more energy efficiency, more demand response, more distributed generation based on just the financial constraints that exist for them. I really love your idea, Randy, that we should get public power providers doing more of this. You know, they really led the way on energy efficiency in the 70s, and maybe they can lead the way on non-transmission alternatives. I would love to see that happen. I also really like your idea of adjusting the return on equity as a way to, you know, tweak this process in ways that feel manageable at this point. I'm not going to say any more about the cost allocation EPSA debate because I actually don't think we're that far apart on it. I do think it's harder for non-transmission alternatives than it is for demand response. The Supreme Court basically reasoned that demand response, you know, directly and measurably impacts what the price is at the margin of the market, and so it directly impacts the rates that people pay for their wholesale energy. And that's the reason that it said, yes, falls within FERC's jurisdiction. There's no sort of like marginal market rate to use here for transmission. It's a longer, more iterative planning process where you would have to, you know, show that over the long term, choosing this option lowered transmission rates. It's a harder argument. I think it's a plausible argument. But I don't disagree with Mike that I do think that including non-transmission alternatives in cost allocation would take the situation to an 11. There's no doubt that this is like an incredibly complicated, you know, clash of jurisdictions. But if that's the case, and if that's really what's going on here, that FERC just thinks that it's too hard to work out how to do that, I just wish that FERC would say it. You know, I just wish that there could be a little bit more of a conversation going on here about these impediments. Because right now, the way I feel like it's playing out is that everyone that's involved in these processes can say, oh, look, we've solved this problem. Like, FERC approved our tariff, and it looks good. But in reality, we all know that it's sort of a dance and that this isn't really working out in practice. And so I think some more honesty here would be really useful. And the only other thing I want to say, I really like Video Mike's point that really this is all part of a larger trend that we're seeing. We're seeing a collapse of the traditional supply hits demand in energy markets, and customers are becoming suppliers themselves, and that's causing the jurisdictional clashes that we're seeing. I think that's right, and I think like the real question going forward is what role for states and what role for feds, and how do we mesh this jurisdiction together? And I think to argue against my own paper for a minute, if states were doing everything they could to promote cost-effective energy efficiency, demand response, and distributed generation, there would be a very limited role for FERC to consider non-transmission alternatives, because you would just see much more of those playing out at the demand stage of the analysis as compared to the transmission development stage. So I would absolutely call for states to do more on this. I think we are going to continue to see these kinds of battles when FERC feels like it needs to insert itself and get the results it needs because it doesn't think states are doing everything they can. Okay, I will close there. Thank you all so much.
I know we are out of time, but maybe we'd take one question if someone has a quick question for the panel. Travis?
My understanding, specific to your regional consideration requirement, or my question is, what will that do to incentives for utilities to join RTOs, form new RTOs, and how does that function in parts of the country like the Southeast and the Tennessee Valley and the Mountain West where there aren't RTOs already? RTOs and new regional cooperation?
I mean, so my thoughts on that, one of the interesting things about Order 1000 is that it doesn't limit its reforms to RTOs, right? It says all regions have to do these things regardless of whether you're in an RTO or not. So if FERC were to require some sort of non-transmission alternatives analysis within regional processes, it wouldn't apply just to RTO regions. It would apply to all those regions. Now, I think it would be a more complex endeavor in non-RTO regions, but the same requirements would exist in both. So I don't think it would drastically skew the incentives of RTO membership. I don't know if you have different thoughts, Mike.
No, I think that's right.
All right. Well, please join me in thanking the panel, and then Nick is going to close us out.
Hi, I'm Nick. I'm the executive editor of LPAR. On behalf of LPAR, I would just like to thank everyone for coming out today and contributing to this wonderful and insightful discussion. I would like to extend a special thanks to both the authors and the commentators for both their written work and for their willingness to come to DC and share their ideas with us. I would also like to extend a special thanks to Aletta, Helen, and Colin. They were instrumental in making sure that this ran smoothly today. I think for the first time ever, we had no real technical difficulties, which is impressive. So props to Colin. And finally, I would like to thank Representative Lance for allowing us to use this beautiful space. Thanks.